Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Letters from the Earth, A Theology for Non-Theologians, Connecting with Earth as Mentor. It is presented by Norman Hobble. The number is HAN 2002-02. Let's listen in.
There's some people here who weren't here last night, maybe a few. Yes. Okay. Those who don't know me, I'm Norm Hubble, and I'm from Australia, which is on the top of the map, that's right. Yeah. We have T-shirts in Australia with Australia the other way around, just to sort of affirm that we are on top. It's interesting how maps were created by people in the Northern Hemisphere, you see. And therefore, Australia is put at the bottom. But the globe spins, as you all know. Who knows where the heck we are. I grew up on a farm in Australia with all of the creatures of the Australian wild right there in the bush near my house. And while I was thinking about this one, I remembered things called bandicoots. Have you ever heard of a bandicoot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A bandicoot is a little marsupial, and they are very shy. But when we would be out as little boys milking a cow on the farm with our hands, we didn't have machines or anything, milking the cow, suddenly a bandicoot would come around the corner, and we'd squirt. That was our game with the bandicoots. Bandicoots and platypus. I once caught a platypus when I was fishing. And it's got this strong tail, you know, and just went, took off. And I didn't keep it, of course. And platypus are very shy, but they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. And there's a famous book out now. Somebody have heard of Umberto Eco? He wrote the book about the library. What's it called?
Pendulum?
Yes, The Pendulum. Mm-hmm. The Pendulum, and another one which was made into a movie. Anyway, he's a very famous writer, and he's written a book recently called Immanuel Kant and the Platypus. Because in the history of classification, they found platypus in Australia, and they carted them over in about 1800, and they could not classify them. Webbed feet, absolutely nothing fitted any of the existing classification system. So that was the great challenge to the whole process of classification. Anyway, Australian, all the animals and creatures are part and parcel of my youth and childhood. Yesterday, we looked at the question of how we might connect with Earth as a parent. In a certain sense, everything we are, everything that you and I are, comes from Earth. The air you breathe, the oxygen in the air, comes from some tree. The water that you drink comes from the ground. The food that you eat comes from Earth. We are children of Earth. Earth, in a sense, is our biological parent. God might be our spiritual parent, but Earth is our biological parent. That's where we get our life from. And we talked about how we might connect with that. And some of you last night, I'm sure, participated in the ritual, which is a very relatively simple one, and hopefully was meaningful to some. That liturgy, that little piece, along with a lot of others, will be all published in a book called Seven Songs of Creation. And it will have about a dozen new songs, like those two songs, as well as seven liturgies, all Eucharistic liturgies, as well as other liturgies. So those materials will be available from Pilgrim Press sometime next year. And we talked yesterday a little bit about linking up with Earth as a parent. And today we want to move it to the question of whether Earth is like a teacher for us, how we can listen to what Earth has to teach us, and whether the Bible says anything about that either. Now, I asked yesterday whether some of you at the end of the session might like to write the letter to Earth the way I started it. And several people have done so. And I'd like to have them share that, because in a remarkable way, the couple of letters that I have read tie in directly with what I want to talk about today. And one lady, who just says Jay, I can't remember her first name, says she has to go off to have some lunch. She's coming back. But this is, she was late coming back from the hike. Now, this is her letter, and I'll ask a couple of other people to read their letters. This is a way of sort of, there's a sense in which this is not just a straight Bible study, but there's also helping us to try to reconnect personally, spiritually, with Earth. And this is her letter. I'll read it. She asked me to read it for her. Anytime I take the time, dear Earth, to be with you, you seem to have something to teach me. Now, that's the best lead-in I've had for a lecture anyway. Precisely what I wanted to hear somebody say. Today, at 3,800 feet, a brook chattered across the path, inviting me to pause and stare at the massive peaks across the valley. Pines embroidered their flanks in living satin stitch. Waterfalls drew lines of lace from top to bottom. Appliques of snow gleamed from the sheltered cradles. And beneath all the beauty you sustain, life, visible and invisible. Beautiful, just as you've done forever. On the scale of importance to insignificant, I suppose I rated insignificant. You murmured gently, and what was it made you think that not taking time to rest will make any difference at all in the grand scheme of things? And then you gave me a stout walking stick from the stream to steady my journey back down the path to supper. How can I help it? I love you. Last night, one of the four people who came up, Parent Earth, we serve you, we bless you, and one of them was, we love you. Thank you for that letter when she comes back. Thank you. Now, there's two other letters. You want to read yours, please? Just so you get a feel for what we did yesterday.
Dear Earth, at Holden, it is easy to feel connected to you, both to be thankful for your beauty and in awe of your power. At home, I appreciate moments of similar connection, in the garden, at the shore, on top of a ridge, yet mostly I protect myself from you, the mess, the dirt, the cold, the wet, the wind. In such a false isolation from you, Earth, I am just a tiny speck. Help me remember and strengthen my root connection with you, Earth, so that I can live aware of my participation in your immense life.
Beautiful. Thank you. And yours. What was your name, sir?
Chris,
thank you, Chris.
Dear Earth, I take you so for granted, you from whence I came and to whom I shall return. You have been my teacher of all that is beauty. You have been my comfort whenever I search for peace. You have been solid under my feet and steadied me on my journey. You have held me in your arms as I have floated in your blue waters. You have provided for my shelter and my nourishment, for my very breath. You have listened to the anguish of my heart and companioned me in my repose. Continue to show me how to serve and care for you, for the small plot of earth I steward, and for the larger realms in which I bear responsibility. Awaken me to a renewed awareness of your gifts for all, that I might be a partner in this sphere of life-giving hope.
Thank you. I'd like to just go back and make us think of points in our past, moments in our past, when we felt that Earth was actually communicating with us. We use the expression in my study, the voice of Earth, but we're not talking about a human voice. Earth communicates in various ways, and that's exactly what was said here and in your letters. Earth somehow communicates. And there were ideas of communication through trees, through whatever. And There's an old song, you know, talk to the animals, well, the animals talk to me. But I think there's a sense in which deep down, in spite of a lot of the other things where we're supposed to be simply listening to God in heaven, we do hear Earth communicating, or that Earth communicates, but not necessarily in the same way that human beings do. We talk about body language. Now, that's not English or Australian. It's language, and it's communication. And so just briefly, before we go into the actual texts and so forth, what are some ways that you might have experienced when you were younger or at some point in your life where you felt somehow that some earth, some part of earth was communicating with you, speaking with you? Anybody?
Can I clarify? Do you mean so that we understood?
Don't have to understand. Sometimes things, communication is mystery. It's a mysterious thing. But you know, you sense that there's a communication, in that there's a presence there that's speaking but not in words. Yeah.
I feel it when I'm in my garden. I can be out digging in my soil. And I don't like to wear gloves.
Thank you.
Old to. I like to feel the soil in my hands. I like to gently take the plant that I'm planting. Say, thank you, God, I love this plant. Grow, make me happy. I'll water you and nurture you. But I feel great joy. I feel close to my Father who taught me to love my garden. I feel ever so close to him when I'm in my garden, and it's a real spiritual experience.
Anyone else want to share something from? Yes.
When I walk through the woods and hear the wind in the trees, and just the variety of sound points.
Ever been to a place where it's absolutely, totally, stunningly silent?
Yes.
Something happens, and you hear something that's not audible when you're in some stunning silence. I find it stark and brilliant. And I once wrote a song about the sounds of silence. I've heard of somebody else who wrote something.
I plant trees, and it's
wonderful.
And it's interesting how when we plant with machines and we're planting in some of these, restoring these riparian corridors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened several times, but you have just planted the tree and you look back and there's a bird sitting in the tree. And it's kind of a thank you.
So the communication may have been with you, but there's also a communication between the tree and that bird.
Right.
And what I've discovered studying ecology, now we have an expert here who's in insect ecology, Roger, and I haven't talked much to insects, but there's a sense in which in the study of ecology it becomes apparent that all of the things that are happening that are connected, whether it's the trees or the path of the tree or the earth, somehow or another, the life process goes on. Something is communicating with something. We've sort of say, well, it's just natural. But when you ask the question of what's really happening, there's a code inside the leaves of the tree that know what to do. And the tree communicates with the bird, and the bird knows to come to the tree. The processes of communication between the forces of life around them are just unbelievably mysterious. I have no idea how a bird knows to do what it does and to sing where it sings. But it does. And it communicates to the birds down there and to the snake down there to get away or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The kookaburra laughs, the snake goes away. The communication processes that are not necessarily human language processes are happening in all kinds of ways in the ecosystem of the world. Whether it's with insects, or whether it's with trees, or whether it's with simply within the mountain. And the communication is there, but it's not necessarily with human words. And the question is whether that whole concept of interconnected communication, which I think is powerful, is that something that's important when we come to say, Earth, help me, teach me. What we've done in this process, this project called the Earth Bible, is to ask the question, does the Earth have a voice? One of the key principles is, does the Earth have a voice? Is the voice of Earth heard? And we are beginning to realize that we don't even begin to know the language and the voices of Earth. But is there anything within our tradition which makes us say, we need to go back? One of the big problems has been that we have disconnected ourselves from Earth. Let's say this is Earth, and Earth has got trees. I'm not an artist, I'm a Queensland. Trees and all kinds of other creatures communicating, and we are here, and here's a human being. Right? And what we have tended to do is to say, we are not part of that, really. We are of a different order, and we've used the concept of being in the image of God. One of the most common understandings of that is that if you're in the image of God and you belong to God, what you've got that's different from the rest of creation is what?
A soul.
Soul or?
Spirit.
Spirit or?
Brain.
Consciousness.
Yes, and there's about 100 different interpretations of the image of God. One of the ones that are really important is that, all right, we've got a soul or a spirit, and the rest are just creatures. Or we've got a mind or a brain, or a reason, and we can reason and think, whereas the others can't. And so we've separated ourselves out as being superior to all the rest. We can communicate. They just do what's inbuilt.
Instinct.
Instinct. And instinct is degraded as less than reason. Isn't it? What I'm trying to say is that the process of studying ecology and studying a fresh Earth, listening to Earth, we are beginning to recognize that we aren't separate. That this whole process of life forces, of both physical life forces and communication processes, are all intermixed. And your line in there which says, I may feel insignificant, but in effect I am a piece of an unbelievably massive puzzle of interconnected. And we've discovered in DNA and all the rest of it that the codes in your DNA go back from you to your grandfather back to everybody. It goes back to Adam. And that interconnectedness is there. But not only to Adam, but to the animals in the garden and the trees in that garden. And the bits of the oxygen from those trees was breathed by Adam, was breathed by you, was breathed by me, was breathed by Jesus. And that interconnection is there. Both physically, as well as I would say in terms of this communication between. And what I'm asking is, how can we go and reread the Bible with a fresh awareness of Earth? And I said yesterday, what tends to have happened is that we read the Bible in terms of the story of God, as Dan calls it, or the story of humans, or the people of God, but we rarely read the story of Earth. My argument is there are three great narratives in the Bible. The story of God, the story of humans, and the story of Earth. Three meta-narratives. The word Earth occurs more than any other word except God. It's the central. And so I'm interested in Earth texts. Earth files, I call them. Those files that tend to have been ignored as we read the Bible. Because we've been more concerned about human beings and not this other dimension. And so those of us who have been working in this project said, how are we going to go about doing this? So we spent a lot of time talking to ecologists. We don't claim to be ecologists, but we needed to be clear about what some of the key principles were that we were going to, the kind of questions we would ask. And the questions were something like this. We set up a series of principles. I won't give you all of them, but just a couple for today. One is the principle of intrinsic worth. In other words, if we are going to speak with Earth and let Earth be heard and recognized, then Earth has to be given, recognized as having intrinsic worth. You could say it's also part of creation, and that gives it worth. But it has intrinsic worth. It's not there just for you to dig up for human resources. It's not there just for utilitarian purposes. It has intrinsic worth. And does the text do justice to Earth? Does it value or devalue Earth? That's the question. Does a given text value or devalue Earth? That's question or principle one. The question, principle two, is the principle of voice. Is the voice of Earth heard, or is the voice of Earth in the text suppressed? So that the voice of humans is primary. Now, it's understandable that if the Bible is written by human beings, their voice is going to be primary. It's likely to be, there's a suspicion that it's likely to be anthropocentric, that is, not Earth-centered, but human-centered. That suspicion is likely to be there when you read. But you need to read it and ask, is there, however, the voice of Earth behind the text that's suppressed? Is the voice nevertheless calling, like we said last night in the hymn? And the third principle, so there's a lot of others, the third principle is the principle of interconnectedness. I'm not going to try and write the whole thing. The principle that I've been talking about now, all of those connections that are there, does the Bible hint in any shape or form that we are not simply a hierarchy of God, then humans, and then animals, and then the rest of Earth? Or is there a sense in which we are part of a unity? Now, those are some of the questions that we ask. And now I'm going to use those questions as I look at a couple of texts that you may not have read this way before. Earth Files, I call them. New Earth texts. Texts that we've read, might be as poetry, but have not read as spiritual and significant for an understanding of the voice of Earth. Now, I'll stop at this point and say, questions. Now, you know feminists have this wonderful hermeneutic, that is, principle of interpreting, which is called suspicion and retrieval. Some feminist scholars here, maybe not, that the suspicion is that the Bible is going to be what? Male-oriented. And that it's likely to have been written by men, and therefore the male voice will dominate over the female voice. On the other hand, if you read some texts very carefully, you can retrieve and discover that there are women's voices in texts which we hadn't noticed before. The same is true, I'm saying, about the Earth. Because it's written by humans, I will suspect that it's likely to be with human domination and human interests primary. But are there passages which also allow us to retrieve and hear the voice of Earth as we read? Okay? Am I clear? Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Now, I'm going to turn you to a few texts. Any questions? Now, the first text is a text that I must have read a thousand times when I was praying in church. It's Psalm 19, I want to grab some. Those of you who want to follow up on the Bible, there are more Bibles there. I'll read it. But I'll read it, and hopefully you'll hear. And then a little bit later, we'll come to the really controversial text, where the trouble is. Psalm 19. And you'll have heard this before. It runs like this. Psalm 19, I don't know what page it is in the book. It comes after Psalm 18. Thank you.
504
in one Bible, one version. It begins this way. The skies are proclaiming the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims God's handiwork. Let me just clarify one thing about that. The word glory, and I'll talk about this in another day, the word glory refers to something quite specific in the Bible. How many of you remember the story about Moses in the wilderness? And then, where does the glory come from? Where do we find, does the glory appear? Anybody? The glory is the fire cloud. Or, in other words, the visible presence of God. It appears on top of Mount Sinai, you remember? The glory comes down and settles. It's the movable, visible presence of God. What does Moses do? Goes into the cloud and comes out all shiny. Remember that? But that visible presence of God then enters the tabernacle. Then later on, it's in the temple of Jerusalem. And then later on, Isaiah and others say, no, that's not just there. The glory is the visible presence of God filling the whole earth. So what you've got here is that the skies are talking, the skies are communicating, the skies are proclaiming the presence of God. The skies proclaim the presence of God. And the skies, which is another word, parallel word for sky, proclaim the work of God. Both the presence and the work of God are communicated by the sky. And who is the sky talking to? Now the wonderful text goes on. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, that is no human speech. Nor are there words. Their voice is not heard yet. Their voice goes through all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. What is that? Communication without human language, isn't it? In other words, the communication process goes on in creation, between the sky and the earth, between night and day, all through the earth, communication happens. And it's declaring and announcing God's presence in creation. And this is one of those extraordinary passages which I would never have thought of looking at if I hadn't thought about studying a little ecology. And the whole consciousness that earth does communicate. This is not just poetry, and your experience is not just poetry, it's something that's real. And so what you've got here is a powerful text expressing the whole idea of communication. Questions? Comments? Okay. Now let's take another text. What sort of communication do we hear earth doing? Let's turn next to Psalm 97. Starting with verse 11. God is coming, you see, and so the text says, verse 11. Let the skies be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar, and all that fills it. Let the field exult, and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy. before the Lord is coming, he is coming to judge the earth. Judge doesn't mean to hurt. That means simply to bring justice, to bring the good things. So you've got the whole of earth, trees, fields, all rejoicing, expressing, communicating in some way. That's the voice of earth that's being heard. Now, one of the things that happens is that we say something like that in our liturgy, all creation joins and sings, but we don't really believe it. We are in a building which has got four walls and usually stained glass, and you can't even see a tree. And so the sense in which I believe we cut ourselves off from what we're saying, and we'll say these words, but we won't really be sitting there in the mountain and actually experiencing and listening to and trying to hear that voice that's being heard. Maybe there are other psalms that you know that are like that. It's similar in the psalm that follows in Psalm 97. Earth is king, let the earth rejoice, let the coastlands be glad. And then it talks about God coming in a storm, and the storm is expression of God's presence. So there are lots of different ways in which God, with earth and creation, expresses its sense of response to God. And then the one that's most known to most of you probably is the last, almost the end, Psalm 148. Psalm 148. This is a wonderful psalm, and it's talking to all of the creatures. Everything from, you know, the antelope to the insect, the whole lot get involved here. Praise the Lord from the skies, that should say, not heavens. Praise him in the heights, praise him angels, praise him hosts, praise him sun and moon, shining stars, highest heavens. Let them praise the Lord, etc. And then the last part's the best. Verse 7. Praise the Lord from the earth, you sea monsters, probably whales, and all the deeps, fire and hail and snow and frost and stormy wind, fulfilling God's command, mountains and hills, fruit trees and cedars, wild animals and cattle, creeping things, and flying birds. So you have a whole sense that all of the creation, not just the animate creation, and what we would call inanimate creation, is also praising and celebrating. And you can simply say it's poetry, but I believe what we're discovering is, in fact, it's far more than poetry, that creation is a communicating, singing, praising, celebrating group of creatures and beings. And the voice is heard in quite a few places in the Psalms. Comments. But, there are problems with lots of places where the voice of earth is suppressed and earth is devalued and earth is not treated this way. I've given you the nice parts. There are problems. There are passages which do just the opposite. And I would now like to follow through on a question that was asked yesterday in line with what we talked about yesterday. So I've summarized this bit in order to get to the part that is a problem. And there are lots of places where there are problems, where earth is not valued and earth's voice is suppressed. And earth, sometimes earth cries out in pain because of the problems, but in other cases, earth is simply squashed. Now I want to give you an insight into the text that is the biggest problem. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. I want you to turn to that and look at it. It's a story about how God created human beings according to the Genesis 1 story. This is the most difficult text in this whole discussion. How does it work? It says, are there more Bibles? I think they're on the top there. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Why don't you read your version of it? Just read what your version says.
Then God said, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them, but God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God said, see, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth.
Okay. Thank you. What you've got in this story, what you've got in this particular text, is what's not true in the Genesis 2 text we talked about yesterday. You have a hierarchy of relationships. A hierarchy of relationships which God is on top. Then it says human beings are made in God's image, however you may interpret that. So human beings are of a different order in this text, it would seem. Then there are creatures over which human beings have dominion, and then there is earth. Now, I want to say that this text is the biggest problem anywhere in the Bible. It's a problem because if you are honest with the text, it says the opposite of what Genesis 2 says. First of all, it says that human beings who are in the image of God, and therefore somehow different, it's not like Genesis 2, where human beings in Genesis 2 were made from what?
Earth.
Earth, yes. And you had this sense of kinship and oneness with earth. And the animals were made from earth, and they were all called the same thing, called Nefesh Kaya, all called a living being. All the family, it was a one family where everybody was together. This is not a family, this is a royal court. Now, the key words that are here are the word rule. Human beings are supposed to rule, it's translated dominion, various other words. For those who are interested in the Hebrew, it's radar. That's the thing a king does. A king rules. A king rules when a king controls and dominates somebody. An individual or a person or a country. When you conquer, you rule. It's a tough, harsh term. And people who try to soften it and make it say it means loving somebody, doesn't. It's not true. It is a harsh, it doesn't mean kind thing. This is a hard word. And it's one of the problem texts. It's one of those texts which has to be dealt with as a problem text and not simply saying what we want it to say. I am an honest scholar. I might find things that you think are twisting it a bit, but when it comes to a tough text, I will tell you it's what it is. That word rule means rule. This word here, what is human being supposed to do to earth?
Subdue,
all right? The translation there is subdue. Now that word, for those who want to know about the Hebrew, is called, is kabash.
Kabash?
Not your kabash. The word kabash is what I do when I stomp grapes. And when Joshua subdued the land and killed all the Canaanites, he kabashed them. To subdue is to crush. Another translation is crush. So, dominate and crush. That's what those two words mean. I am not going to be scholar who is dishonest with the text. This is the problem text of the first order. And the problem is that this one text has become the normative text for a whole discussion of how we should relate to that. And it's been the basis upon which a whole lot of the history of Western Christianity has said, we have a right to do all this, to subdue the earth, to harness nature, all those kind of harsh words, right? To clear it. We have a right to clear it because we were told to dominate, right? So this mandate to dominate is become part of the history of Western thought, and Christianity has been heavily to blame because we have bothered to make, or frequently made, this text the normative text. Now, in the discussion that was going on before about homosexuality, it depends on which text is for you the normative text. You can't make every text normative. The one you're going to be decisive. For me, the gospel is always the primary text. The gospel is the primary text. And when somebody says something that is in conflict with the gospel, then that has to be judged in the light of the gospel, not the other way around. What has happened is that this text has become normative and primary. And what I would like to suggest is that we don't make this text normative, but we make a different one. Now, before I go that far, I don't know how much time I've got left. What time is it?
5 minutes to 7.
5 minutes left?
No, well, it's oh, 20 minutes to 7. 20 minutes.
20 minutes. 20 minutes. Thank you. There are a lot of scholars who say, Havel, what you got to do here is to go to Psalm 78, right? And that's where you've got a king, a king ruling, and if a king rules justly, then that's what this should be. This should be ruling justly. And I said, it would be nice if that's what was the case, if it did say rule justly. But you turn to Psalm 78. The point where it talks about ruling is the point where it says the enemy should be under the king's feet. That's total domination. It's crushing of your enemy under your neck. That's where the word rule is used. The word rule is not used in connection with justice. The word rule is used in connection with crushing. So Psalm 78, not helping, it hurts you. It makes it worse. So what I'm arguing, and this is a key part of the whole debate, which text do you take as the text you want to have understand our relationship to Earth? One that goes back to the old royal conquest kind of mentality, or a different one? Yesterday, you remember, those of you who were here, we looked at Genesis 2, verse 15. Adam is made in the garden, and God creates this forest home for them, the trees that are beautiful and trees that have fruit, and the family lives there. There's God the Father, who is the creator, and earth, and Adam and Eve, and all the animals. They're all in the family together, and everybody's living harmoniously, and God says, this is what your role is on earth. This is what God says Adam is supposed to do. Adam has to do two things. One is till, but the other meaning of that word is serve. Serve earth. That's the way I ended last night. Go in peace, serve the earth. I took it directly from Genesis 2, verse 15. I wasn't talking about worshipping earth as some people thought last time. So the word there is abad. Now, what you need to know is that those two words are diametrically opposite words. You cannot make this mean that. This is the servant, the slave, or even worshipper. You serve the Lord, you worship the Lord. So this is a serve mentality, this is a rule mentality, and they are diametrically opposed to each other. I will stake my academic reputation on that, as well as my Australian reputation. This is point one. Now let's go to the other side. What was the second thing that Adam was told to do in the garden?
Keep it.
Good. To keep. Protect. And the verb there is shamar, for those who are interested. These two words are likewise opposites. So what you have in Genesis 2 is a totally different mandate about how you're supposed to relate to Earth to what you have in Genesis 1. And so my question is, how do I make a decision? Which of these ought to be now in this day and age for you the normative or the text, the preferable text? Now I can just say, well, I like the second one, this one, better. But there might be a good reason why you like the this one, the serving one's preferable. There might be a good reason why you'd make that. That would be preferable. What would it be? Why would you choose, in spite of the fact that historically this has been the normative text by most thinkers, theologians, and so on, maybe we had it wrong for a long time. We had a big debate about women's ordination in the church in Adelaide. And I was saying that, well, you know, I think we probably, the time we changed our mind about this, we had it wrong. One guy said, you mean to tell me the church has had it wrong for 2,000 years? I said, well, you know, Luther said we had it wrong for 1,500 years. I'm so, what's the difference? It was a few hundred years. The answer is yes. Why would you choose the one over the other now, as opposed to the history of Christianity? Why would you choose
that? Because of women being equal.
All right. Which one? You would choose this one?
Well, that one says male and female, God created them in the
image. Yes, and that's another reason why that text has been given strong emphasis, because it's emphasized male and female.
At the same time, it's not Adam first and Eve second.
No, it's not. On the other hand, this one here, all the creatures are part of the family of God. But there's another reason. Why would I want to choose this one over that one? Well, not so much in relationship to the question of male-female, but in the question of ruling over earth and crushing creation.
Jesus tells us to be servants.
All right, text. You take Mark 10. That's the gospel. The gospel has us oriented towards each other. Christ says, you shouldn't be amongst you like the Gentiles who rule and dominate. You should be among each other as people who serve. Just as Christ came to serve and give his life a ransom for many. In other words, the gospel orientation to each other, to life, is an orientation of serving. There's a new insight. That doesn't mean one needs to deny the mutuality of male-female as being in the image of God. What I'm concerned about is how we relate to earth and to creation and to animals and the like. And I would argue that it's time we emphasize the second of these texts as being a preferable way to relate to the and to allow earth to be heard. Whereas in this one here, earth is virtually, the voice is no longer heard. It's subdued. It's the voice of a slave isn't heard. Whereas in the other one, the potential for hearing voice of the earth is there. Comment. The Mark 10 passage, I don't remember the exact verse. 45, yes. I know it's about. That text makes it clear that we are to relate to each other, took everything from the way that Christ has set the way. That is a way of serving. In a sense, there Christ is the second Adam as well. Now, I could go with a few other texts. Another text that's a big problem, which is parallel to this, is Psalm 8, where human beings are told that animals are made to be under their feet and a lot of other things. So it's not the only problem text. And there are a lot of other problem texts in other areas. I simply want to highlight that when we're talking about this thing, there's going to be a lot of debate for you, and you'll largely come across people saying, the problem is that we haven't read this text right. For me, the problem is that we have to face the fact that often within the Bible, there are two diametrically opposed positions. That can happen. The Bible is not harmoniously the same everywhere. They're often diametrically opposed positions, and you need to know on what grounds you will choose one or the other. And I would say that in terms of consistency with the gospel, Genesis 2 is far, far superior. Questions?
So what is the origin of the two different traditions? Why are they so different? Why did they both get included in the Book of Beginnings?
Well, there are lots of questions about them. Why did you get conquest in one text and friendship in another text, you know, in the stories about the land? You know, in Abraham's story, you've got a friendship relationship in trees. Mm-hmm. In Joshua 1, you demonize the enemy. And you've got diametric opposed ideologies in all over the place. And what's happened historically is that the Bible is a collection of writings from different people at different times with different orientation. And remarkably, because I think it appealed to our ego, we have chosen the Genesis 1 text as the one we like the most, rather than the other one. But the two texts are, I would contend, quite opposed to each other. And it's important that we realize that the Bible is full of it, and therefore we also need to, if that's the case in the Old Testament, we're going to read the Old Testament, at least in some sense, in the light of the New. We need to know what is the gospel orientation. And when you go to Romans 8, what happens in Romans 8? Is earth ignored? No, we hear earth groaning, crying out. There you have the voice of earth, not in praise, in an agony. Huh? And so, and that text, you see, says, well, I don't want to be crushed anymore. I want to be liberated. Any other questions? Comments? All right. Yes?
Backing up a little bit, could we say that scientists and their best mode are actually listening and reading some of the voices of nature better, say, than the church or theologians? Or
I have a number of books now written by scientists. Paul Davies is one. One I have up in my room. It's called The Mystery of the Sacred, Mystery of the Sacred in Nature or something, and it's by a scientist. And they are, many of them are beginning to discern the unbelievable dimensions of that mystery and the communication that's going on in the world of nature that we have basically sort of ignored. That our real communication is with God, and we don't have to worry about communication with earth. And I'm saying that there is, even within the biblical tradition, plenty of evidence that we should be listening to earth, but also worshipping with earth. If Psalm 100, those psalms say or do anything, Israel was worshipping with earth and not simply hiding it and cutting it off. You know. Thanks. Any other comments? All right. Now, I believe that, you know, we need to keep thinking about this, and if you get into any debates, this one will keep coming up. It's inevitable.
Another thing to think about too is that prior to the industrial age, a lot of the heavy labor was performed by beasts. oxen and horses.
Yes, that's right.
Things like that. So, you know, and the interpretation could be just from from society and culture of the time.
That's right. Yes, everything is culturally determined to some extent, yes, when it's written and who it's written by. Yes.
In these sorts of discussions you've been having, where does the concept of evolution and what we know about the development of humans all the way back through fishes to worms and stuff?
That's a whole big ballgame. A friend of mine in Adelaide called Dennis Edwards has written a book called The God of Evolution. Roman Catholic priest is part of the same group that's doing this earth study stuff. And he's done a very good job of trying to make it clear that it's not contrary to the very nature of God to affirm evolution. Now, I don't usually talk about evolution, and I'm trying to understand first and foremost how these texts have been important in the history of Christianity apart from the question of evolution. But what is clear is that the whole business of the communication process and the transformation and the whole, all the genetics and all those other things that have been going on, that the evolutionary process has been an unbelievable mystery. And that evolutionary process would point to the interconnectedness of absolutely everything, both from the beginning on. And if God is indeed the life force, and Earth is a living entity, and God is within Earth, then that's not inconsistent. There are different pictures. And there's not just one picture of how humans came in the Bible or how Earth was created in the Bible. We all listen to Genesis 1, but there are lots of other pictures. And so the picture is not singular. And I would say, while I'm not discussing the question of evolution, that it's a different way. It's a different way of understanding how God was functioning. And it wouldn't necessarily be wrong if that's where you felt and understood it to be. And the Bible is a portrait that was written at a time when people had a limited understanding of creation and the world. That's understandable. So, if you wanted to, and I have not been doing that, that's not what I'm here for, but to explore the processes whereby God works through what God has created to create. And that creation, Lutherans have a doctrine of creatio continua, that God doesn't stop creating. God is creating in, with, and under everything from the beginning. And whether you argue for a one-time thing, or whether you argue for it as being a process, God is in, with, and under it. Scientists would argue that the Earth is a piece of stardust. I don't know I can't explain. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know. What I'm interested in is the question of how we as Christians use our traditions positively in relationship to it.
Question?
Yeah.
Would you say, up here.
Ah.
Would you say that, therefore, that the notion of the image of God is also problematic?
Yes. Very problematic. Problematic in all kinds of ways, but it's against. It's positive in the sense that it incorporates both male and female. It's positive in the sense that it honors human beings, and it doesn't say God is just a king. It gives a royal dimension to human beings. But it is a problem in the sense that if you read the text, as I do, then the outcome of the image is to control. Now, whether you say that the image equals God's mind, the human beings have a mind, or they have a consciousness, or they have a soul, or whatever it is, the expression of that in the next verses is in terms of control. From that point of view, the image is a problem. I think when Christ comes, there's a transformation of that understanding in the New Testament. But that's something Barbara would know more about. I would argue that it's problematic if it stays. And in the history of the interpretation of that of the image of God, there are hundreds of different interpretations. And my understanding is that it's, if you take it as part of that total text, then how I express my image in the text is to do two things, to rule and subdue. So it's a problem text in many ways.
Because with that notion of the image of God, it means that that which is truly intrinsic are humans in the creation. That humans are what it's all about. And if you take the pyramid and turn it upside down, humans are what the creation, the peak of the creation, and everything else is based on it. Or on top that they rule everything.
Yeah, that's the way it is. Now, you could, I mean, I believe that Genesis 2 tips this whole thing upside down and gives a whole very different thing. And it doesn't have a hierarchy in the same way. You have a family model with parents and life givers and the whole family with all kinds of creatures as part of that family. It's a very different picture to the picture of this one. Two radically different models. Okay? You want to keep going on that?
Well, then you get down to...
Which one do you choose?
Well, I choose the second.
Thanks.
Well, Jesus came because that which was most valuable got in trouble, and he rescued that which was... I mean, he just goes...
Yes.
It,
yes.
Everything is built on that.
Yes.
No, except that at least Paul says that Jesus didn't die just for humans. He died to redeem the whole creation. That's what redemption is about.
Yes.
I'm just saying from... That's the way that text has been interpreted.
Yeah. It certainly is clear that the cosmic redemption is there. It's not just a human, not redemption, just the redemption of human beings. The whole of Earth is being, as Dan has been saying, the whole of Earth, the whole of creation is also part of being redeemed and rescued and mended, as you said, as word used. And in the Winnipeg LWF assembly, we're talking about healing, and the expression there is healing creation. And the language of healing is being used. And that's a positive expression which also grows out of the cross. Yes?
You're saying that in the New Testament, perhaps, this has all changed. If I understand you right, that the image of God, then, is not just to rule and dominate, but in Philippians 2, for example, if we could read it this way, because he was in the image of God, he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant, so that the imago Deo is not just to rule and dominate, but actually to empty oneself and to serve.
In Philippians 2, the imago is totally transformed into the Genesis 2 model. Yes, correct. So he empties himself and takes on the form of a slave. Precisely the same word, a servant. Yes.
Oh, Harold, I just got to say that I bet you're right on the translation. I think the although that we put in Philippians 2, I bet it's a participle, and I bet there's no reason to be reading that as an although. It could just as well be a because.
Because he's in the image of God.
Uh-huh.
Yes, well, then that would be a radical and a legitimate... Yes, I agree. And we've talked about that elsewhere. Yes, exactly. Because he's in the image of God, therefore, and God has decided that the only way to redeem human beings is to be a servant, and is a servant. And so, that's quite the opposite of what it is here in Genesis 1. It's the reversal, the gospel reversal. And I'm arguing for gospel reversals all over the place, not just in this text. And if you don't believe in gospel reversals, then you're going to live in the Old Testament for the rest of your life. Make that equal to the New. So this is one of the gospel reversals, but there are, and the image is another one, I think, in Philippians. And there are other places where you'll have gospel reversals. We live in the gospel, and so we need to read lots of texts which have been seen as being laws for life in the light of the gospel. This is exactly what was happening in the previous session, isn't it? Now, those of you who want to, tonight, write a letter to Earth. We talked about the possibility that we would collect all these letters at the end of the week and put them together in a Letters to Earth from Holden, a little collection, or use them in worship next week. Feel free, I will be going fishing tomorrow and I will enjoy the hike as much as I will anything else, and we'll continue on Thursday, and on Thursday we will go to the text, Genesis 1, not just the part that I talked about, and do an earth reading of that, which I believe is the best bit of the whole thing. And maybe an Aboriginal version of it as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.